Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 69 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So announcements this week. We got several pictures from the Outlander Stars Instagram account. We got a shot of Graham McTavish looking very stoic on his horse.
I just like his hand on his hip.
Is the horse's name Thistle? I don't know why I think that horse's name is Thistle.
I don't know.
There is a horse, I think, on set called Thistle. I'm not sure. But if it's not, it is now. That's Thistle. There was also a shot of Hugh Monroe getting all decked out for the scene they did on the... was on like the bluff? What would you call the precipice?
It was outdoors.
The rainy overlook picnic, which was the worst picnic ever. Like if someone took me on a picnic where it rained on me the whole time, I'd be like depressed.
I don't know. I liked that the smoke effect.
Well, they had that interview. Was it last week or the week before? Where Katrina was being interviewed and she spoke to that picnic as well, which I thought was funny. There was a video released by Outlander Stars, a little short video of Wee Hamish, Roderick Gilkinson.
Part of their Outlander offerings for the month of December.
Yes. They're, what, like the Advent, the Outlander Advent?
Kinda.
Yeah. Cute little interview, cute little boy. Very well spoken.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Germany has now started to release trailers for the upcoming Anfang. They've got three so far, and it's interesting to if you go and watch them because they're actually dubbed in German. We were also delighted to find out that Outlander made BuzzFeed Entertainment's 29 hottest TV hookups from 2014, and there were 29 of them. And I think I just said that, and that was redundant. However, we got not just one showing; we got two. And we got the number one spot was Claire and Jamie's wedding night. And we also got the number 17 spot, which was the Claire and Frank downtown. Because it's the one...
And her scene with downtown.
Yeah, that's what it said. We don't have any official dates, but according to the Herald Scotland, Outlander will finally be screened on UK television next year. Mm-hmm. So... And if they're lucky, maybe they won't have a hiatus like we do, and they'll just get all of them back to back.
It depends on when they start, obviously. If they start in January, there's going to be a little hiatus. If they don't, you know, if they started, March. Even February, I guess, they could technically... Well, even if they started at enough time to have the episodes 9 through 16 when we get them... We know from, like, even from our northern neighbors, Canada, they're not going to get them the same day. The U.S., I believe, Stars would get them first. So even though they could have them, like, back-to-back, my guess is they would either be a small window or separation, or if they wait long enough, they could absolutely go straight through, but the equivalent of episodes 9 through 16 would be viewing there after the U.S.
Didn't, like... One country get, like, all of them at once?
I think
the first eight all at once.
Well, that is all of them so far.
Well, yeah,
Not before we got them. No, it was after or just as we had them. Or in some cases, think New Zealand was one. I have a friend in New Zealand, and it was Lightbox, I believe, that had it there. And that's a streaming service.
Mm-hmm.
So they literally, the day it opened there, the day it was... available there, they had all the episodes that had thus far been shown. So then, as they became available. So if it depends on the service, if the service that purchases the rights, or if the company that purchases the rights is like a Netflix, like it seems like Lightbox is,
mm-hmm.
or something like that, they have the ability to stream them all Make them all available at one time. Which is kind of nice, but I don't know. I couldn't binge like that. Because I would binge on all of them if they were brand new. I would never sleep. I'm happy that we get them week by week.
Oh. And that is announcements. And now, on to our read-along. This week we are covering Chapter 8, which is entitled Unlaid Ghosts and Crocodiles.
So Jared is gone. Jamie, Claire, and Myrta are in Paris, and Diana describes Jamie's daily grind. Deliveries, inventories, dock visits, and tours of unsavory taverns. Claire is thankful, however, that he's got Myrta with him, as she would not trust anyone more than him to take care of him. That's a lot of hymns. In the evening, Jamie gets social, then comes home, does some paperwork in his study, and then it's time for Din Din. Yes, I said Din Din.
I imagine it's France. I imagine it's a little bit better than Din Din. A little bit higher scale.
Oh, no, of course it is. They have servants and courses and all of that. So Claire wasn't so fortunate as to have built-in activities to occupy her time.
No, but I did enjoy how she described it as she was basically having a war with the housekeeper and losing.
Other than approving the menu for the day and various purchases and opening various things with her key bunch, she was bored.
I would love that kind of boredom. I'm going to be frank, but I'm not Claire.
You're not going to be frank.
I'm not going
to
be frank.
You'll never be frank. Jamie took pity on her and asked her to copy some ledgers in his office. And that is how she was in the room when Mr. Silas Hawkins came in. Ellen G. shares, "Enter Mr. Hawkins, Mary's uncle, to add some tension to the story." So we'll get to Mary in a bit. But yes, this is a great way to, you could say, a lot of tension comes from this scene.
Absolutely.
Later on.
But what I did want to point out was something that struck me as I read it. Because we all know that Diana doesn't do anything without a reason. And she has a line that Mr. Hawkins says, where he says, "My best suppliers, I do declare," he declared. And I was like, that was... The use of the word declare twice in that sentence I thought was very strange. Mm-hmm. Which leads me to believe that this character, perhaps, is very big on making declarations. Like, everything he says is, like, some sort of a declaration. But I just thought that was strange that he would say declare while the character declared.
That would fall in line into some of the descriptions we have of him coming up. Mr. Hawkins is English. Diana describes him as having, quote, "permanently flushed cheeks and jolly smile of a reveler." But he was a calculating man. Then Mr. Hawkins begins to ask Jamie some questions or make statements and seems to be fishing for information. It starts with, "Are you over from Scotland recently?" Jamie answers, "No, they've been in France for some time." And his answer is short and to the point. No extra information.
It seems to me that he's trying to measure just what type of Scot Jamie is. Is he a loyalist? Is he...
He's just trying to... I don't want to say weasel. He's there as a very legitimate customer. But he's... Yeah, he's trying to fish. Well, going fishing.
I think that being a merchant in that time period and being in a foreign country but of another foreign country, I think that they ride this line because they're merchants. They want to sell their wares and they don't want to get too heavily involved in politics because at the end of the day, they're still trying to sell their stuff. So I think that he's measuring him up to try to figure out, is this somebody who's going to be a problem?
Or just, is this someone that I can, I don't want to say commiserate, but I can work with in other means than just do business with? Then he asks something to the point of, "What are the current sentiments prevailing in that part of the country," meaning in the Highlands, having recognized him as a Highlander? Quote, "One hears such rumors, you know." Rumors abound in Scotland. He doesn't have attention for such things. And this is Jamie. And while having this, I guess you'd say, conversation, this specific one, Jamie is studiously sharpening his new quill. Seems he's making a point to concentrate on this task.
He's making a point. That's funny, because he's sharpening a quill.
Yeah. Ha ha ha. That's funny. So Hawkins uses the word struth to form a question. According to OxfordDictionaries.com, it is British, and it's an informal exclamation of surprise or dismay. In other words, he probably or maybe doesn't believe Jamie. Jamie finishes sharpening his quill, holds the point up, and squints to judge its angle. Another, to me, telling thing is the men. I mean, definitely we know Silas is from all the questioning. And this, to me, is more evidence, I guess, that the men are sizing each other up, trying to figure out what the other is, where the loyalties lie of each. Then he says, I've heard Charles Stewart has recently arrived in Paris. Diana describes him as his face not showing much interest, but his eyes being alert.
In their pockets of fat.
Jamie answers flatly. He signs each page of the order, quote, with excessive care. And Jamie just doesn't... He signs each page of the order, quote, with excessive care. Jamie just doesn't do this very often. And Diana gives us, through Claire, a description of not just what he's doing, but why it's so out of the ordinary because of his being left-handed, then being forced to write with his right hand being injured.
It's also a testament to the way Diana writes, because she writes each book as though the reader hasn't read the rest of the books. Like,
oh, yeah.
And this was... And also... I should say that for the readers of this book, it's been, for the people who read this when it first came out, I should say, there was a significant amount of time between the release of Outlander and the release of Dragonfly and Amber. So it's almost like a, hey, here's your refresher course.
She's very good at that, and she gives just enough information to fill you in, but you don't feel like you're being, lecture is the wrong word, you don't feel like you're being patronized in any way.
Right.
It's just enough description that it fills you in, but it's not so much so that...
It's not too much rehash.
If you are...
Well, like I said, I read the fourth book first. So having read the fourth book first, I had enough information to finish the fourth book without having to go back, but I was still able to enjoy the first four books because she didn't give away everything.
Mr. Hawkins continues with, do you share your cousin's sympathies, meaning Jared's? Jared is a well-known Jacobite. Diana gives us one of her gems. Quote, Hawkins sat back a little, watching the crown of Jamie's bent head, which was naturally rather noncommittal. The crown of your head is probably nothing more than noncommittal.
Here's what I'll say. Years and years and years ago, when I was in acting school, one of the things you had to learn was that even when your back is to your audience, you still have to act. We had entire exercises where we had to turn away from the audience and play
a certain emotion.
Exactly. Play certain emotions and see if we could still telegraph that emotion from all of them seeing basically is like our backside. So there is emotion to be derived from someone's demeanor from looking at them without seeing their face.
So only then does Jamie push back a little. He says, is that any concern of yours, sir? He gives Hawkins a stare, which he returns briefly, but then waves his hand in dismissal. Hawkins is the one who broke first. Now, that may not be important, but I found it interesting. Jamie and his non-committal crown win. Jamie basically says that two Highlanders will rarely agree on one thing, so political leanings ought not be expected to be shared, necessarily. Claire astutely chooses to step in at this point and play hostess. Hawkins declines the nibbles she offers, and then we get to more of the storyline. Hawkins is to travel to Calais to meet the Arabella, on which his niece, Mary, travels. She is arriving from England to meet and marry her soon-to-be betrothed, a member of the French nobility. She is 15 years old. Claire tells us, the name seemed familiar, but I couldn't think why. Mary Hawkins. Undistinguished enough, I couldn't connect it with anything in particular. We find out Mary hasn't met her husband-to-be, in fact, doesn't even know she's coming to be married. Claire is appalled, but Jamie keeps her from speaking.
And he deserves some sort of an award for that, because we all know that Claire is not to be stopped.
Most of the time, no. As Hawkins heads out, we find out that the fiancé is a member of the House of Gascogne.
He's also a member of the Elderly Gentlemen's Club.
Yes, and quote, revolting old beast with the snuff stains on his cheek who came to dinner last week? Claire asks. The Vicomte Marigny was a widower. And in typical Jamie fashion, he defends the other man, or at least wants to set the record straight, on the matter of the snuff stains. He says, "I didn't think it's snuff, though. It's only the way his beard grows. It's bound to be a hellish shave with all those warts."
Aww. That doesn't help.
No. And this is exactly the type of affair that could get Claire into trouble, where her 20th century values clash so harshly with those of the time. She can't believe they would be able to marry Mary to the older man, and Jamie says, "They can, and it isn't your affair." It may seem harsh words, but, I mean, just think back, I don't know, in the book, what the timeline was, a few weeks, a few, maybe not a month, but it could have been a month, a few weeks to whatever ago, where a certain 20th century English lass who happened to be married to Jamie walked into the area of a boat on the docks and basically gave the death knell for a ship that had to be destroyed by fire. So yes, Claire, sometimes you need to be checked. Your mouth needs to be checked.
Well,
her intentions are good.
The issue wasn't so much that she did what she thought was right. It was the...
She doesn't think the fallout about no. consequences.
No, ever. Ever. But that if she did, we wouldn't have it a wouldn't story. Be Claire. Come on. She wouldn't be Claire if she didn't. If she true. Thought about consequences and kept her mouth shut every time she had an inkling to go Claire-like, then this book wouldn't be nearly as frustrating and fascinating.
Speaking of forced marriages, Jamie reminds her that, yo, chica, you were forced to marry me.
Oh, come on. We can't compare those two things.
Of course not. But he says it. And she resolves to meet Mary Hawkins and speak with her about the marriage. Ellen G. comments, "The tension coming from what Claire knows and what she is experiencing in this time. And it comes to fruition when Claire realizes who Mary Hawkins is." And just as Ellen says, then Claire goes white and basically freaks the freak out. Or sorry, she freaks Jamie out. She remembers where she'd seen the name. Jamie was wrong. It was her affair. She'd seen the name, quote, "written in a copperplate hand at the top of a genealogy chart, the ink old and faded by time to a sepia brown. Mary Hawkins was meant to marry Jonathan Randall in 1745. Ellen also shares, "This brings in the discussion of Frank and BJR and them saying out loud what neither has said before about BJR's death." So that brings us back to the topic of Jack Randall. He's dead. They both believe he is. They were told he was. But Jamie is a little affected. His voice becomes clipped. He recounts, "Marcus McGranick told me he'd seen Randall trampled to death by cattle in the dungeons of Wentworth Prison. Quote, a rag doll rolled in blood. He was very sure about it." Claire agrees and says, "No, you're right. Captain Randall is dead." It just gave me a turn remembering about Mary Hawkins. It seems to me that they're doing a lot of reassuring of each other. That's all I'm going to say.
Well, I mean, to each other. Of course, but think of what it would mean.
I don't know what it would mean.
Otherwise.
It would be scary. It's just funny that they're both saying, "Oh, he's dead. Oh, no, I know, I'm sure he's dead. Oh, no, I mean, oh, remember what Marcus McGranick said? Oh, yeah, I know, it's just a little, yeah."
The whole basis of where they are right now, emotionally, mentally, and everything, is based on the fact that this gentleman is dead. So I think that were that not the case, everything would be different.
Emotionally for the two of them.
Yeah. Well, and mentally too, because they
still would probably be fleeing and on the way to France and then end up in Paris. I mean,
right, but they'd be fleeing more than what they're fleeing now. They'd be fleeing doubly, I would think.
Yeah, because
he's the big bad boogeyman.
Yes.
With the taste for Jamie's flesh.
Stop it. Of course, this reminds Claire of Frank. Jamie says, "You know he is dead, do you not?" Speaking of Frank. Claire is, however, not so sure. If he's dead, if he won't exist because Randall is dead, why does she still have her ring on? A small muscle near Jamie's mouth twitched. He too was pale. So Jamie's mouth does a lot of twitching. It's usually in humor, but it's also in, I don't say fear, but in being freaked out or something.
He's just got a twitchy mouth.
It's one of his, it's a tell. It's
I wonder if his mouth ever stops moving. Because it seems to always be twitching in some manner.
So the two of them discussed how Frank had made quite a deal about Randall's death dying at Culloden and his son being born a few months after that. Jamie is trying very hard to find a way for the details to match up, for Randall to be dead and Claire to be there, her ring to be on her finger, for Frank to still have been born. He says maybe it's Mary's line, not Randall's, but Claire points out that they were almost doppelgangers. There's yeah. no way he wasn't part of Mary's line. Jack's line.
But poor, I like how he finally is like, well, maybe it just doesn't mean anything.
I know, which is
when
just...
When you reach the point where you give up and you're like, but it has to mean something. Because, paradoxically, if she goes back in time, she would never have gone back in time if she hadn't been married to Frank and been in that place and gone back in time. Which means that if she'd really undone that, technically, she also would have disappeared.
So poor Jamie's sweating now. Then he says, that's what you said. Perhaps the ring means nothing. And I wrote, not likely, Jamie. Claire says she doesn't know, and he says he doesn't know either. Jamie asks to confirm that Frank had told her Randall would die at Culloden. Claire says yes, and describes how she told Randall this to his face when he set her out in the snow before going back to Jamie in prison. And Jamie reacts violently. His whole face is like spasms. He covers it. Jamie, you can't cover that, my dear. He covers by saying that he's tired from writing all morning and he has a headache. He brings the conversation back around to their goal in Paris. If they knew Randall would die at Culloden and he ended up dying at Wentworth, they can change the future. He uses this as hope for them and their goals.
But what they don't take into consideration is the fact that perhaps this is what happened the whole time, which would mean that all they were doing was putting into motion the same thing that had been happening forever and ever and ever and ever and ever in a cycle.
Yes. Claire wants to cancel their plans that night because Jamie's not feeling well, but he says he only wants a nap. He claims the headache is from the writing and that a nap will help. But then he says, which kind of speaks kind of against what he just said-ish, and if I should call out in my sleep, just lay your hand upon me and say to me, Jack Randall is dead, and all will I be well with me.
So, y'all, if I ever get married again, I'm going to tell my husband to do that to me as well.
That Jack Randall is dead?
Yeah. If I ever stir in the middle of the night.
Or Jack Bauer. Did Jack Bauer die? I didn't watch that show.
I don't know. I don't watch 24. And
I almost called it 21.
And it's Kiefer Sutherland to me, so I really don't care. But if...
He's a sweetheart.
If you say so. But... if I ever wake in the middle of the night, that will be what I ask to do. Just put your hand upon me and tell me Jack Randall is dead. And all will be right.
They return that evening after dinner, tired, and they go to sleep. But Claire wakes in the middle of the night. Jamie gone. She sees him in the window seat. She saw something in the way he sat that made her go to him. He was, quote, breaking hard as though he had been running, drenched with sweat. Did I write that correctly?
It's breathing hard.
Oh, my gosh.
You're welcome. I'm like, break it. I'm like, was he dancing? How do you... like, break dancing? You got the cardboard box
Jamie
out on the ground.
Break dancing in the window seat. Oh, my gosh. Okay. Breathing. Wow. The things that word will not change because it's written correctly but used incorrectly.
Oh, my God. Please have an outtake of Sam Heughan break dancing.
No. So he's drenched with sweat. He didn't see her. She yells at him. And he seems to finally snap out of it a bit. Jamie had had a dream. Finally, he's telling her a little bit more about Wentworth. Specifically, pretty much all of Wentworth happened after she was set out in the snow.
Well.
So I was about to say, what happened after that? Well, this whole thing happened after that. Okay, this is a line that I must have missed every 70 darn times, however many times I've read this book. I don't know why this did not, like, stay with me. I went back and read it, like, 6 times going, wait a second. Is this right? No, I'm wrong. No, I'm right. No, I'm wrong. And I think I'm correct. What do you... tell me if you picked up on this. Okay. He starts to tell her. But before he actually gets into the story, before Claire tells us he's telling a story, this is Claire's voice here. And as he spoke, meaning Jamie, the shape of Jonathan Randall walked the room and lay naked in my bed atop the woolen blanket. I don't know what kind of crack I was on to not notice this before, but she's having like a waking waking. She's having like a vision?
No, I feel like that was metaphorical. Like she's saying bringing him up.
Of course he's not there.
Like for instance, if they shoot this scene, I don't think they're going to show Tobias Menzies walking across the room with his dingling hanging out and laying on the bed naked.
Oh no, I guess he did walk. I said he didn't walk, but he did walk.
I think it's just her expression of stating this room is heavy with the memory of
Yeah, but Jack a naked Randall. Memory?
Well, he was naked when he raped Jamie.
Exactly, which is it's a little bit too descriptive of just memory. Now, we know he's not there. He's dead. But
Ginger, they can't see you. I know.
I just did little
air quotes.
He is dead. As far as we know, he is dead. And I think that's why I always skipped over this because I assumed it was completely symbolic. Like, as he started to describe this big bad thing, I could feel the presence of Jack Randall, right? I get it. But as he spoke, the shape, come on. That's very, like, summoning kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. And I thought about it. Oh, Lord, is there any water around anywhere? I'm like, only Jamie's sweat. I don't think Jamie's sweat is enough to do like a seance.
A ewer and a
Yeah, but there has to be some kind of intent, right? Gila's had the water. She was going to do it. And
are you about to rap? Because that almost sounded like you were going hip-hop on me.
No. And Roger didn't have the intent necessarily, but he intently got into the water on purpose.
Correct.
So the only water around is Jamie's sweat that we know of.
No, honestly, I feel like in this instance that it was literally just metaphorically like, his presence was between us because we spoke of him. And we brought him to life in our minds because of this conversation.
I get it. And that's how I felt every other time I read this. I don't know where that emphasis came from. That's what I had in my mind normally when I read this. But this made me stop. I'm like, wait, why in the hell is Jonathan Randall naked? I mean, in the prison, I know.
I mean,
Why is he naked? Why is he naked in... There is no naked symbolic-y.
Symbolic-y?
There is no... All she would have had to say is, and as he spoke, the shape of Jonathan Randall walked or appeared or whatever, or bloomed. Oh, bloom's a little bit too happy. Appeared or walked into the room or entered the room. That's all you need to say. Why the hell mention she just talked about her woolen blanket on the bed because the covers were gone and all she had was the thin woolen blanket. This is the same freaking blanket she was just laying under.
I think
this is her bed.
I know, but I think symbolically his nudity has to do with the fact that what they're discussing was not just Jonathan Randall. It was Jonathan Randall
naked?
Because it was Jonathan Randall sexually assaulting her husband.
I get it, but just his menace. Just him being there in the room as Jamie is talking about all the stuff that went down
or up.
Summer.
What?
All the stuff that happened, you don't need, except for in that room in Wentworth, you don't need a symbolically naked Jack Randall.
You always need a symbolically naked Jack Randall when played by Tobias Menzies. And you should have thought that all on your own.
I said to come out, we can't talk about Tobias Menzies naked.
Why not?
Because that's not classy.
It is. It's so classy.
It is not coming in. I mean,
it is so coming in. I think that the bottom line is that most people have read the first book going into this. Okay. But for people who maybe perhaps do not remember everything that went down at Wentworth, which I can't imagine any book readers to not remember
but
that
there
pivotal
is stuff
scene.
That he says coming up that we don't hear in book one.
I agree with you, but I think they're setting the scene for the reason that they're bringing him back up is that the horrible things that happened to Jamie at Wentworth were emotional and sexual and all of those things together. And that's why it was so horrific to him, was because he couldn't just separate. It wasn't just physical and it wasn't just sexual. It was all of the things combined, but it was very part of Jack Randall was a very sexual thing, and him being naked is very representative of that.
I agree that it is symbolic in that he is not physically in the room.
Of course he's not.
But what I'm saying is, why have you could say, you know, the ghost, right, if he's dead, since he's dead, the ghost of, or the embodiment of, or whatever. Jack Randall, metaphorically, symbolically, whatever, entered the room as Jamie was, like, about to spill forth with the nastiness of the story, that this gross, this terrible, terrible thing that happened to him. You could tell, like a black cloud entering the room, basically, right? Yeah. A black, ominous cloud. Got it. You don't gotta describe the fact that the black cloud is naked on your bed.
But I think you do. And the reason I think you do, at least... I see it being something Diana chose is because Jack Randall is guilty of many, 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 many awful, horrific things that he did to Jamie over the course of Jamie's life and their interactions together and the things he did to Claire. The thing they are about to speak of was very specific, and it was the time that he raped Jamie.
I'm not saying anything about
that.
And
I think that if they'd just been talking about the time that he whipped Jamie or the time that he was mean to Claire or those things, perhaps him being naked wouldn't have been an issue. But the fact is they're speaking of a specific horrific incident. And I think that's where the nudity comes in.
And everything that you're saying is supporting what I'm saying. You may not believe it does, but we both agree that it's symbolic,
but
it's
metaphoric.
But you
keep saying it's not necessary.
It isn't necessary. It makes more sense, and it's a stronger statement that he is naked. We agree on that. What I'm trying to say is we're both saying that it's metaphorical because we know that he is not there in the room. He's dead.
Of course he is. Or is he?
But what I'm trying to say is this is not in Jamie's mind. Randall's always in Jamie's head, unfortunately. So we know that's not from him. This is still from Claire's point of view. So Claire is the one saying, as Jamie started to tell me about whatever he was going to say, the figure or the whatever of Jonathan Randall walked across the room.
Yeah.
And lay naked on the bed. I mean, it's not just the fact that he appears, right? He's naked. He strides. Well, Dan does not describe the way he walked. But he had a purpose. He walked frickin' to the symbol of their marital union. A frickin' bed. Because you're right. He got literally in bed, I mean, not literally, but almost very figuratively, literally in bed with Jamie. And we know from, has not said it yet, but we know from book one that, as you said, it was not just physical or sexual or all of that and brutal. It was all of that, but it was even worse because he brought Claire up to Jamie and basically had, I don't want to say brainwashed, but he remember that? We talked about this at the end of book one. He, through what he did and his torture and his speaking of Claire and bringing up her name, he caused there to be this association between Claire and the disgusting things that happened to him, that were happening to him, whatever, to become worse, to make him feel worse about it, you know, not expecting him to survive and get out and, you know, recoil from his wife, no, but to send him to his grave with an aversion to his wife, which was the most cruel thing of all. So
was a very Jack Randall thing of all.
Well, which is makes it brilliant for Jack Randall to do. So my point is having him there first makes perfect sense. Okay, got it. Metaphorically, he entered the room because Jamie was about to talk about him. But the fact that he's naked, I agree, makes a freaking statement.
I think there's two things. And I know we've been talking about this for a while. I think that him being naked makes a statement. But him being naked and then laying on the bed, atop the blankets, as opposed to underneath the blankets or climbing the bed.
He's not getting cozy.
No, it's not even that. It's a sense of I have no shame. I've done nothing wrong. And I feel no regret for anything I've done. And I'm here of my own volition and screw all of you. And that's
an attitude thing.
Right. But that is an embodiment of what he would do if he were there, I think.
And he walked across the room. So he appears, again, symbolically. He appears, or metaphorically, sorry. He appears. He's naked. He walks with a purpose towards the bed. He didn't just, like, appear in the room and, oh my gosh, he's in the corner and he's there and we know he's there because you're about to talk about him. No. So it's like several things, right? He's there. He's naked. He walks towards the bed. And as you said, like basically, he may not be spread eagle. Basically, they're going, look. What? What? That's what he's doing.
No, he is.
With his face, well, not his mouth.
He could be doing his gesture. Johnson. My point is that the fact that he's naked and laying on their bed with no shame is the point here. And I think that we've belabored on this. Is that a word? Belabored?
Belabored the point?
Belabored.
I don't think we belabored the point. We've talked, we spent some time on it, but I, like I said, I think, I but never I think we're almost this just line. Talking the
same thing over and over again.
Excuse I me. Think we started off saying, I think this. Okay, but I think this. But ultimately, I think we're in agreement in most of these points. It's there. It's to make a point. But what I am so baffled at is how I could have missed it the first 7 times I read this line. I never took it. I think I read so fast or listened without listening carefully enough that I assumed it was Jamie. I did not catch the laying naked on the bed. I mean, I was like, wait, hold on a second. I literally, when I read for this to take, I had to read this like 7 or 8 times. I mean, I was like, wait, the what? He did the what? Whew. So, yes, I don't know how I missed this line before. For real. This scene could be spooky. We don't know if they're going to keep it in any kind of adaptation, but holy monkey, you said that they would not do this. Honestly, it would be interesting if they did.
I don't think they will.
I don't know.
I don't think they will because, like I said, it's not that he's actually physically there. It's a metaphorical thing. So they can...
Which would be even more effective if they didn't look
no,
at him.
No, but well, it would be more effective if they just show that feeling in their faces.
They're going to show the feeling actors. In their faces no matter what.
They don't need a literal Tobias Menzies walking across the room and laying on top of the coverlet naked. To get that feeling across, which is the whole point of this.
They don't.
Because he's not really there.
You can do it with lighting or make him, like, halfway see-through. I don't know. My point is, yes, you don't need him there.
I know.
But there's and the adaptation's not the book.
I know, but for non-book readers, could you just imagine how weird that would be?
If he's dead, then they know he's dead.
But just to... It would be so random.
It would be random.
They'd be like, wait, what?
It would be symbolic.
Boo. I'm saying, boo on your symbology.
I'm not saying they do. It's not mine. I'm saying, yeah, it's an adaptation, which means it's not literal, right? It's not page for page, word for word. We get it. So there are choices that are made. There are things that are changed. That's fine. I'm saying it would be interesting if they did that because, and I personally think it would be effective because, darn, I mean, it freaks me out just reading it. If they had it, it would be sinister. What's coming up now is one of the grossest and most difficult scenes to read for me to read or to listen to. And some of the words I will not say. And Summer will not say. I find it very disturbing as it's meant to be. Basically, in Jamie's retelling of what went down in the prison, he, meaning Randall gives Jamie the mental image of a hanged man and discusses how his bowels will loosen when he dies. As Randall spoke, quote, a long, slim hand came around his waist, gently stroking the slope of his belly, teasing its way lower with each word. And that's about as much as you will hear from my lips.
No, but
I can't quote any more than that.
You don't have to, but the only thing I'm going to say is one of my least favorite
words,
terms.
Ever? I know, don't say it.
I can say it.
Summer, please don't.
I can just cover your ears.
I'm in the room. Like I have to edit it, Summer. I know what you're going to say.
I know.
Okay, yes.
Of all of the words.
If you say it, wait a second.
I'm not going to say it in context. I'm just going to say the word.
I know that, but don't. If you're going to say it, give me a second.
Okay.
So, for me, I can't quote any more than that, except that here's another mention of the effect at the end of that little quote I gave earlier. It's another mention of the effect of the smell of lavender and what it has on Jamie. It was Randall's scent. So, okay.
Can I say it now?
Do what you gotta do.
Okay.
Oh, burr, 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 burr.
So, I mean, I think it's true of most words. There are lots of, like, synonyms for different words that some are easier to listen to.
I'm gonna use the word funky.
Okay.
That's all.
Go ahead. You can do that.
I will.
But... There are definitely a bunch of words that can be used to describe certain things. But that being said, the word that she chose to use is literally my least favorite word used to describe that.
Oh.
For serious.
For serious.
The word spunk is not anything I would like to use in that context.
And that is the only time you'll ever hear it in this podcast.
Because other than that, I like to say spunky.
No, not anymore. And other things. I don't want to ever hear that word again.
But I would never.
Like Spunky Brewster?
Sure.
Oh, that's Punky Brewster.
No, that's true. It is we Punky. Can't. My point is like I would describe somebody as spunky, but not in this context. But with this context, like that word, for whatever reason,
has lost all of its charm.
It's so not charming.
Not like this.
No, I hate that word.
And from
like,
Randall's lips, brr.
For some reason, I don't know why, but that word made the whole conversation just worse.
It did. I know. That's why I said I can't. It's a difficult scene. I don't want to brr. Bird, girl, I can't.
So you're welcome. I said it for you, but
no, is that you're
no
welcome.
One likes that word.
So I can actually say that though I... Okay, Summer, this may surprise Summer here. So I can actually say that though I still don't imagine Sam as Jamie when I read or when I listen. When I read the line, quote, his grip on my arms, and Jamie is holding Claire's arms out. I mean, Jamie is holding on to Claire's forearms. Quote, his grip on my arms was tight enough to numb them, but he wouldn't let me move closer. He held me away as surely as he clung to me. When I read that line and I envisioned some man, Jamie, holding the arms of some woman, Claire, I saw a flash of Sam. That was the first time ever. I think because they've been in such... I mean, I don't know. They haven't had this scene yet. But they've been in scenes where... He hasn't held her, like, tight or anything, like, around the arms. But they've been close up and had, you know, kind of brusque words. So maybe that's why. Because it kind of filled in... I don't know. But I saw it for a flash. Only on that line. So, okay, a tiny bit of a change.
My brain has fully committed to
Sam. We know this. Jamie tells Claire to go to bed, that he'll be all right. She does as he bade her earlier and tells him, it was only a dream. Jack Randall is dead. There is so much I'd like to say, but we can't quite yet. Before we go on to the frog shop, is there anything else you'd like to say about that yummy scene?
I mean, I'm fairly sure we just talked for like 30 minutes on the fact that Jack Randall actually naked on their bed.
In the morning, Jamie wakes up and he is his normal self, only he's still in the window seat. Claire discovers she is missing several herbs for a sleeping draught for Jamie and thinks she'll go to Raymond, the herb seller. And this just makes me laugh. He's a wizard.
I would like to say...
Jamie was gone, and so she'd go. Because she already said, are you... When they were at the Royal Audience, right? She was like, Jamie, are you for real? You don't want me to go see him? And he's like, no, you know, I don't want you to. And she's like, okay, well, Jamie left me, and he's up, and whatever. So she went.
With this chapter, we meet what I would say is arguably the second most loved side character of the entire series.
After Murta.
Murta is obviously like a number one in our books. However, Master Raymond is a close second. Which is funny because he's only in this book right now so far. And this is the only book where we actually see him right now. There's going to be further.
He's in a bulge.
Further in. Okay. Dirty.
He's in a bulge. Not my words.
Of course he is.
Master Raymond.
Raymond.
Mr. Raymond. His shop. The shop is described so well. I wonder, this made me think of, and I know we haven't seen everything yet, but it made me think of some of the stuff we have seen, coupled with some of the details we've seen or heard about Galus's attic room, and we haven't seen the seance yet, but that would probably be like hot tamales. I can't wait to see that.
Dude, if it's anything close to Claire's surgery...
Oh, for crying out
loud. I don't
even
want to talk about it.
Okay, so my point is, I wonder how closely John Gary Steele, the production designer, and his team will stick to this. This description was another thing. Diana gives such a wonderful description of this shop. So LNG says...
Okay, every time you say that, I think it's like an acronym for LNG.
No.
LNG.
So LNG shares... Next turn, being introduced to Raymond. Claire is in the shop. She asks for Monsieur Raymond, and she is corrected, Maître Raymond. When the young woman...
What does that mean?
Maître? Master.
Yeah, master, okay.
Which, haha, Master Raymond. When the young woman points toward the end of the shop, there are, quote, sinister clouds of a brownish smoke. that floated out over the door. Claire also remarks on this setting, quote, smoke drifted up from a black slate hearth to coil beneath the low black beams of the roof. She describes a wonderful alchemical chemistry scene. Glass alembics, copper pelicans, someone's been doing some distilling. And we will include a picture of what one of those pelicans is. Not of a copper one, but of a glass one. And she smells... So thus far, yes, we've gotten a description of the shop. We've gotten a description of when we are first introduced or first shown Master Raymond. It is in and around or among sinister clouds of brownish smoke. So it's very mysterious and, you know, like not quite otherworldly, but very, very mysterious. And with all of these distilling instruments. And she smells strong odors, alcohol, and yes, discovers that although he may have a good run of things in the shop, he mostly probably makes the most of his money by selling his high quality cherry brandy. So even Claire's and our first glimpse of Raymond literally is described as, quote, crouched over the fire. So all of this about herb seller, a wizard, someone doing, it's not said alchemy or anything, but someone doing distilling, you know, kind of an air of magic about him. It's this air of whatever you call it is part of him and is never separate from his character. It is always, it's something that makes him even, it reflects his mysteriousness, his mystery.
But you know what is separate from his character? All of his teeth. He apparently has no teeth.
So let us get the entire delicious description in. He, quote, resembled nothing so much as a large genial frog, a touch over 4 feet tall, barrel-chested and bandy-legged. He had the thick, clammy skin of a swamp dweller, and slightly bulbous, friendly black eyes. And as Summer said, he was also toothless. Here's another interesting thing. So we have the conditions in which, the environment in which, as well as the description of Raymond. When he greets her with Madonna. So much has been said and discussed about his name for Claire, and a little bit more about this comes up later in this book, right?
Oh, yeah. This is the only book he's really present in with the regard, with the exception of the bulges, apparently.
A bulge. He catches her in her staring at him. And she says she'd wondered if he'd been kissed by a beautiful young girl. He's a mensch. He really is. He takes it in stride and even goes along with the joke, and they both laugh at it.
Now, how long ago was the Frog Princess story written?
I don't know. You'd have to see if it's one of the ones that is...
It's one of the...
It's either was Christian oral tradition? Or... Grimm collected fairy tales. The brothers Grimm went around the countryside and collected them. And they were linguists.
It was a Grimm.
It was?
Brothers Grimm.
Okay, so they collected it, so it could have been traditional. Oh, Frosch, isn't it called Froschkönig? So, we don't have the exact year, but it seems that the Frog Prince was collected by the Brothers Grimm and then written down, which means it was passed orally first, or that's what they wanted to do, would go around and collect traditional fairy tales or stories, and... It was called, is called to this day, the German, the story, Der Froschkönig, the Frog King. And that would have been in the 18th century, correct?
Well, the Grimm brothers were alive from the 1785 through...
Yeah, 17th century.
1863.
The Grimm brothers did not collect it and write it until the early 19th century, likely.
Well, probably either late
but 19th if they were 19th. If they were born in 1785, they were not doing it at 15 years old. That's 1800. So likely the brothers Grimm collected it in the early 19th century. It is not impossible that a common story could have been known by him if he had traveled, or maybe there was a German. Maybe there was a French version of it, of the story, if it was common enough. We don't know. So if anyone out there knows about this, you know, that would be interesting to find out. So Master Raymond also has long silver hair to his shoulders. this, again, depending on how close they stick to this description, this might be one of the hardest people to cast.
I mean,
the toothless part may just have to go.
I feel like he's a teeny tiny toothless Gandalf.
So he attends to something briefly, and Claire has a look around. There's lots of clutter, as she calls it, and also a crocodile. She refers to it as a belly scoots. I had to look this one up. It's not a term for the crocodile, rather for its armor. Scoots are bony protuberances that are part of the dermal exoskeleton. So belly scoots are scoots that are on a belly.
I mean, that makes sense.
Exactly. Claire demonstrates her nasal prowess, and he is impressed. She identifies elements, different herbs, as well as the carrier oil, in one of his jars. We find out that he is not altogether honest in saying what is in his concoctions, and that the people at court are much more gullible than Claire. When she refers to the crocodile, he says he inherited it from the previous owner of the shop, and he also appears to show some unease. This is something that I also don't remember picking up on before. Do you?
Which part?
The fact that when he says he inherited it with the shop, he shows some unease when saying this. Because she never presses him about it, and he never goes on about it. They switch subjects, but he shows unease when talking about how he had inherited the shop. Claire doesn't think she's necessarily wrong, but she does say that she has spent a lot of time at court with Jamie, and one of their main things is to read people and try and find out people. And so she does say that, you know, maybe I'm just reading too much into something because this is what I've been doing for the last weeks or months.
Well, I got the impression, I mean, with most things in that time period, and I think probably not today, but a lot of times when people took over places, obviously they put their own stink on it, if you will. But when they go in there, they're like, okay, here's what I got. It's like when you look at older countries that have so much more history, like than the United States do. Like, we don't have a lot of buildings that were built in the 1700s or the 1600s or the 1400s, because that's just not when we had buildings built here. But if you go to other countries, like, half of the things there, like, the cities are, everything's built closer together because they don't have any more room to expand. So they all have these old existing buildings that are, like, now they all say, oh, they're pre-war, oh, they're pre-whatever. So when they have this existing building, they're like, oh, well, I'm going to take over this area. It's already built. There's already stuff in here. I kind of know what he did. I'll just continue with what he did so that everyone who used to come here is still comfortable coming here, and then I'll just put my own stink on it.
Yeah, but to me that doesn't mean unease necessarily.
Well, obviously, I think so, that there's more to it. I think that
the way that
he maybe came into being what he is,
it's
maybe
one of two things. I think, well, it could be more.
Up and up.
I think could be one of two things, and maybe I'm missing one. One is the way he came into it, and two is maybe the person he got it from. You never know. So LNG says, I think he is looking at Claire with the same fascination and knows she is not who she says she is on many levels. He can see that she has a glass face. So he says, oh, you're a professional. You don't look it. He puts his hand on hers, and she finds his touch oddly comfortable, quite impersonal, but unexpectedly warm and soothing. Unusual for someone's ungloved hands to be warm at this time of year. She tells him she is a healer. He still calls her Madonna. LNG shares, and this is something that I went back and I picked, then I could see what she was saying, but I didn't pick up on it again this time, the first time reading through this time. Master Raymond says, calls her a professional, or says, you're a professional. And she basically says, that depends on what you mean by professional.
It does, because in current days, if you called somebody professional, they probably would think you were calling them a hooker.
And that's exactly what she thought, or what Ellen thought. He still calls her Madonna, which in that context is kind of funny. But, okay, more about Raymond. He was easy to talk to, and very knowledgeable indeed, and about the uses of herbs and botanicals. There was a kerfuffle in the store. The Vicomtesse de Rambaud, Raymond says, quote, she's rather expensive. And that made me think of a whore. But no, he meant it was expensive to clean up after her. The woman threw something at the door and demanded a black potion, which the shop girl got directly from Raymond. The woman thinks it's poison, we find out, but it's actually bitter cascara. This will make her rival ill, please the woman that she's got her money's worth. But then, when her rival or the other person recovers, the Vicomtesse will attribute it to a priest or a counterspell. He explains that he'll get his money back when she comes in to purchase an abortifacient. It's all in the timing, you know, he says. The Vicomtesse makes her way out, and the people are scrambling to get out of the way of her coach. Claire says under her breath, "À la lanterne!" And then, quote, "Ask not for whom the tumbril calls, it calls for thee." There are a few things going on here, and it was fun to look these up. Okay, so, "à la lanterne" literally means to the lamppost. But during the French Revolution, the lamppost came to have a special meaning. They were used by mobs sometimes to hang officials and aristocrats. The lantern became a symbol of street justice. And we'll link to some information about this. The line, "ask not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee," is a slight, very slight rewording of a line from a poem of John Donne's. That line is, "and therefore never send to know." To send to know would be to want to find out, or you could say to ask. "And therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee." Claire has replaced the word bell with tumbril and toll with calls, respectively, to say, "ask not for whom the tumbril calls, it calls for thee." A tumbril is another reference to the coming French Revolution. Claire admits some of her schadenfreude. "It was rare that my unusual perspective on current affairs afforded me much satisfaction, but this was certainly one occasion when it did." A tumbril is an open cart that tilted backward to empty out its load, in particular, one used to convey condemned prisoners to the guillotine during the French Revolution. So yes, Claire's remark was very pointed and very purposeful. Then, the Madonna and the frog get back to business. Ellen shares, "Claire must feel somewhat comfortable as she opens up their speaking to him with mentioning being kissed from a beautiful princess, and she's not put down for it. He doesn't get after her. He's not astonished, maybe a little surprised, but doesn't really, you know, talk down at her." It clears the tension and makes way for the beginning of a good friendship, perhaps, as they get to know each other.
And that was chapter 8.
So thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/OutlanderPod. Or email us at OutlanderPod@gmail.com.
I dreamt it last night that my young